WRCT.
WRCT.
Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh.
So I wanted to talk to you all a little bit about conceptualizing spirituality in Black faith communities and the cultural schemas that exist around prayer, illness, and healing. But first, let me tell you just a little bit about myself. So I was raised in the Midwest by a family that pretty much migrated from the South. And so I was raised in a very firm Southern Christian Baptist faith, very traditional. My grandfather was a deacon in the church. My grandmother was a mother in the church. I was a junior nurse. I was in the junior choir. We went to church every Sunday, most Wednesdays, and some Saturdays. And as a matter of fact, in my household, if you didn't go to church on Sunday, there really wasn't much else you could do the rest of the week. It was off limits. Growing up in the church really did instill in me a lot of the lessons that have given me the strength to be the woman that I am today. What I learned very early in that setting was that God heals us. Prayer heals us. And those messages were bountiful throughout the church. I could recite songs that kind of speak to that. If you think about Psalm 147:3, it tells us that God heals the brokenhearted. He binds up our wounds. I can remember my earliest testimony. I was maybe 9 or 10, and I had a situation where I was getting ready to go somewhere, and in the Midwest, we have basements. I know that's not something that you guys have, mostly in Texas, but we were a working class family, so we had an unfinished basement. I was going down the stairs, and I tripped. Right before I hit what would have been the concrete floor, my foot caught on the railing. That was God. I went to church. I went to Sunday school. We prayed about it, and everyone talked about what a good Christian kid I was and how I was saved, and that my prayer is what healed me that day. Sometimes the spoken and unspoken messages in the church is that if you're strong, of good faith, and you lean not unto your own understanding, and definitely not the understanding of others, then God will save you and heal you. However, what I've learned over time is that that message can sometimes incapacitate Black women's ability to seek help when they need it. I remember very vividly a story of a woman that I was working with once, collecting data, who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And she belonged to the Kojic faith, so the Church of God in Christ. She recounted to me the story of how she went to church after her diagnosis had been revealed, and they tried an exorcism on her to remove the bipolar disorder from her, and how damaging that experience was for her. This is not uncommon when you think about the conflict in spirituality between faith communities and mental health recovery. For African American women, and for most Black women, we are held to these cultural stereotypes, these tropes. I'm sure some of you have heard of them. The superwoman, where we can do anything and everything all the time, perfectly. Oftentimes at a consequence to ourselves. There's also the trope of the mammy, where we are the nurturer. Come to us with your troubles, talk to us, we will listen to you and take care of you. If you're in our family, if you're in our community, if you're outside of both of those things, our arms are always open and welcome. You've probably also have heard about the sapphire. This is this angry Black woman who has this unbridled anger, who's enraged all of the time. These tropes that kind of circle around our own community impact Black women specifically because we spend a good deal of time either trying to counter all of those narratives, we're none of those things. We try very much so to own each of those different pieces of ourselves, or we try to navigate and find a way to vacillate between those different narratives. I am this or I'm not this. And it can be exhausting. It can cause some significant mental health distress. These challenges with our mental health histories for Black women, oftentimes because we serve in those roles with consequence to ourselves, it costs us our own mental health. We don't seek out the services and support that we need to. And our faith then tells us that we shouldn't need to seek out these outside pieces of support because God will heal us. He is there for us. Prayer will save us. As I evolved as a Black woman and as a Christian, I started to notice the conflict between these two areas. My work, when I provided clinical services to individuals, my research working with women with severe mental illnesses, has told me that this is not sustainable. So there has to be some type of other options. What is it that we can do where we can maintain whatever our spiritual grounding is and tells us, but also find ways to seek out support and services where we need it? That tells us, hey, go to the medical community. Seek out some forms of treatment. When God alone isn't saving you and you're still experiencing your mental illnesses, then that's the option, right? But what we know from the research is that cultural mistrust is real. We understand historically that the medical community has used black bodies without their consent and abused that use to advance medical technology. Those advances sometimes have often reinforced the systematic oppression that has occurred for black people. So the medical community is not always our first option, our trusted option for us to seek out. There's a conflict there. If our spirituality isn't serving us, if the medical community, we're just not sure if they will serve us, what do we do? Where do we go? How do we address these issues that we're facing that move a little bit beyond the blues? We know that women experience mental health issues 50% times more than their male counterparts. But we also know, for all of those people who express having psychological distress, that black women tend to seek help 50% less than their white female counterparts. So we are out here with the exact same level of psychological distress, needing the exact same supports and services. If we're like the former person I mentioned that I interviewed, not able to seek it out from our faith community, if you're familiar with what happens in medicine, not able to seek it out from the medical community, and we're at a little bit of a loss on how we travel this path to recovery. Most of us aren't even aware that there is an option for mental health recovery. We resolve that this is our path, this is our state, this is where we need to be, and we toil through it. Oftentimes you'll hear black women say something, "I'm just making it through." And that is our superwoman trope at play. That is our way of saying that we're going to continue on this path that we are, with or without help, because we just don't know where to go and because we know it's what we do. On one hand, that demonstrates excellent resilience, and I think that that is a key characteristic for a lot of black women. On the other hand, when we do finally seek assistance, we're at a point where our symptomology is more severe and more acute and more chronic and has had more negative impact than what we would have seen had we sought services earlier on. So how do we bend this together? How do we blend all of these different aspects of what we need, these conflicts in our healing, this conflict in our spirituality? What do? We have to start to think about how we present narrative. What's the conversation surrounding mental health and recovery in black communities, specifically for women? How do we balance out? Sometimes I am a little bit of a superwoman. Sometimes I'm a little bit of a sapphire too, and that's okay. But when I know that I need help, there's a resource there for me. We need to find a way to get our faith community to stop pathologizing and demonizing mental illnesses. At the same time, we need to get our treatment communities to stop pathologizing and demonizing our spiritual histories. The conversation has to happen simultaneously. Now, it's not to say that there hasn't been efforts in this. There have been. If you look at the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, they've partnered with black faith communities and other faith communities to develop what's called NAMI FaithNet. And this is a great resource directed towards spiritual leaders to give them the language to talk about severe and persistent mental illnesses in the church. Black churches are very okay with talking about depression and anxiety because we all get the blues. We all get a little riled up. But when you start talking about bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, major depressive disorder, they're a little bit silent. Our therapeutic communities are very open to looking at some of this change. NAMI, a national organization for mentally ill, has also partnered with Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated to start to bring the conversation into the black female communities so that we can have these larger conversations. But what happens when we go to therapy and when we say we were talking to our grandmother about what we've been experiencing? or we were talking to God out loud and having a conversation. That sometimes is pathologized. And so there has to be a way to have both of these communities, both of these sides, figure out how to have different conversations. I recently attended a training for work that talked about crucial conversations. There's a book out about that now. Some of you have probably heard about it. It's fairly popular. It's a new way to kind of have difficult dialogues. And I think when we talk about faith and mental health recovery for Black women, that's a difficult dialogue. That training was a day-long training. I can't remember a lot of what happened because it was exhausting. But one thing stuck with me from that day, and that was the use of the word "and." When you have a conversation, when you're in a disagreement, don't say "yes, but," say "yes, and." And that somehow really resonated with me, thinking about how do we blend together faith, my spirituality, and my need for mental health resources. Even when I think about my own path and my own mental health history and seeking out services, I remember how shy I was about talking to my family about it. I remember the discussion when my mother found out I was in counseling and what she thought about that. But I think what was missing for me, even to articulate it to her, was the "and." Me seeking out treatment doesn't mean that I wasn't also praying. I definitely was. If we can focus the conversation on "and," you can pray, you can have your spiritual depth, you can walk your spiritual walk, and you can seek out treatment. And you can take medication, because that's a big step for a lot of people in the Black faith community. You can do both of those things simultaneously and remain in allegiance to who you are as a person, who you are as a spiritual being, while you are allowing God to provide the resources that are available to you to heal you. So for all of you here, for the people who are practitioners, when you're talking to Black women about mental health and recovery, talk about the "and." Figure out how to infuse their spirituality into the work that you're doing. If you're a faith leader and you're talking with someone who's struggling with a mental health challenge or a significant and persistent mental illness, provide the options for them to seek treatment while you pray with them. If you're just a friend or a spouse or a peer of someone who is struggling with the balance of what do I do with my faith when I sit down or I take my Xanax, or I talk to a doctor, or I tell someone secrets of my family, tell them they can do both. You can be spiritual. You can walk that walk. You can take your medication. You can treat your illness, and you can recover.
I went to Vietnam in late 68, early 69. I was a little over 18. Couldn't wait to get there.
I was going to A Company 501st Aviation Battalion. This is September 1965.
I was in the 559th Squadron, and I flew 201 missions there in combat.
People always, when they want to get you in a corner and talk about Vietnam, I said, you don't have enough time today for me to sit down and tell you all the experiences that I had in Vietnam. The day that I got 25 holes in my ship, I said, and the instrument panel was shot out. Or just when I got short and I was showing a new pilot how to make a gun run and a bullet comes up and goes straight through between my legs, I said, you don't have time for me to tell you about that.
I learned how to visually track the enemy constantly, night, day, through rain, through water, through triple canopy jungles, ocean. And along with that training, they sent you through dog handler schools, combat tracker team. A lot of people totally forgot about that we were the first to make contact with the enemy.
I attended Howard University and was commissioned through that source. From there, I went to pilot training.
I went home after my sophomore year and I told my dad that I was wasting his money and my time. A week later, I was in the United States Army.
Well, I joined the military being surrounded by Marines, Navy, and of course, Seymour Johnson Air Force Base. And it was a fascinating thing to see those people in uniform. And to watch people jump out of an airplane was just something that just took the breath away from you. I couldn't wait to get that age when my parents would give me permission to join the military. And I immediately checked airborne.
I knew I was going into the Air Force to fly. I graduated in the upper 10% of my class, so I had a choice, you know, bombers or fighters. So I chose fighters, which I always wanted to fly, because the Tuskegee Airmen was my influence.
I went through basic training. I was the outstanding graduate of that brigade.
I'm one of the first 11 black African-American students to walk at an all-white school in 1968.
When I graduated from OCS, I went to airborne school right after that. And then after airborne school, I went to Fort Knox, Kentucky. And I was an XO in a basic training company. And then they switched me over to become an instructor.
When I left the ROTC program at Tuskegee as the Commandant of Cadets, I was sort of looking for a job. Now, it turned out that my former boss, Frank K. Evers, he was the commander of that training wing of F-4s. And sure enough, he hired me as an instructor to go out at Davis-Monthan in the 4453rd wing, the 4456 squadron.
Eventually, you know, you get enough time and you go on enough combat assaults and you go on enough ash and trash, you become an aircraft commander. And I did that.
I had some very, very good instructors and leaders to say, go do it. Don't let nothing hold you back, because being raised in the South, you always had that fear. Well, should I get in it or should I not get in it? And I must say I had white instructors and leaders that pushed me to all the way to where I am today.
Left Davis-Monthan in November of 66. From there, I went to Cameron Bay.
We were up near the Cambodian border in 25th Division, and we had gone up there to support them, and they were in heavy contact. I mean heavy, heavy contact. And the CNC ship, the command and control ship up there, called me and said that they're running out of ammunition. And would you go down and resupply them? Whenever I was going to put my crew in danger like that, I always talked to them, and I said, what do you guys think? I said, let's go. And so we went and got the ammunition, and we got, boom, turned around, boom, came out. Not a hole in the aircraft. Okay, flew back up. Billy joined on me again. And then the CNC ship asked me the second time. He said, we have some people down there that are severely wounded. He said, if you don't go and get them, he said, they're going to die. This time, the guys were ready for me on the other end up there. And they started shooting at me. And I told the guys, get them in here. And I looked over my shoulder, and they must have put pressure on one of the guys, because he was, I mean, the blood was just coming out very thick. Anyway, they fired an RPG at me, and it missed. Anyway, I told Billy to stay out of the area, Billy Miller. And Billy went right over the top of me, and I saw his aircraft wobble. He got hit. He got hit, personally. And the other two guys that we took back survived. Years later, Billy and I were both colonels at the time, and Billy was down at Fort Bragg, and we were at the officers' club. And I said, Billy, you remember that day that I told you to stay out of the area, and you flew overhead and you got shot? He said, oh, yeah, I remember. I said, you remember I told you not to come in the area? You know what he told me? He said, Larry, he said, I saw the fire that you were taking. He said, I couldn't stay out there like that. And Billy was white. I didn't give a crap what he was. You know, he was my friend.
You don't really know the character and the quality of the people you're working with till you get in combat. And then you really know who they are.
When an aircraft went down, everybody came. When I went down my second tour. I wasn't shot down. I lost an engine. I was on the ground for about 30, 40 minutes, but Jesus, I had all the help, and they had, I never forget, the two F-100s that came and started circling around, and they put a slick in there and picked me up.
They were solid citizens. You could count on everybody in my squadron, and I'm sure the other squadrons as well, to do what they were required to do.
You get closer to war dogs than you do to your own house and family dog, because you know the value of that dog. The first tour, I got shot up real bad. I was with the 101st Airborne, and I was called out with the 1st, the 187th, and they had received enemy fire, and they had the ambush. And of course, we jumped right on the mission. You don't ask no questions, you just go. Now me, my dog rappelled with me because he had got so used to the harnesses that we had made for him. We call it jerry-rigged. And once he get that harness, he knew he was coming out of a helicopter. Immediately, I put the dog on the trail. The jungle got so thick, so they sent a person with me with a machete. Even though the dog could go under, they needed to cut that area where I could walk through, which was quite dangerous. As we went, I don't know how many kilometers it was at that time. I would say a couple of clicks because it was like 3 or 4 hours. My dog alerted. I told the commander, I said, sir, I said, well, this is my dog is alerted. It's time that I turn the mission over to you now and let your people move forward, because it's just the dog and I. We're out front 150 yards or meters or whatever it was. His word was to, I want a KIA, and our mission was to get one. And I don't want you to pull off this mission. So Ben is, as a good soldier, I continued the mission. Now, what I did do was put the dog behind me and put him on a shorter leash, because I had him on originally 25-foot leash. Labradors did not bark, did not make sounds unless their handler was really, really in danger. So he barked twice, and I knew that was trouble. Well, as I turned to signal that it's really bad up front, it just opened up. And all I know that I was trying to protect that dog. That was my main thing. And I was able to push the dog away from me. When I did, I got hit in both legs.
My first mission was a Sunday morning. We fanned out, the three of us. And when I rolled in, as soon as I was leveled out with the target and was ready to pickle, I saw something in front of me, a big boiling black thing that turned red, you know, fire. So I started jinking away from my initial track and reacquired the target. And as I pulled off, most guys break left. I broke right. And sure enough, the explosion had tracked me to go that way. And then coming back home, we were all white. That's right.
After getting out of the hospital, I started going to the leadership schools. Being a weapons person, I was in charge of all the weapons, all the college kids that came through ROTC right out of college. My job was to teach them to shoot properly, and also to dress properly. So one day I come by, my first sergeant said, here's a copy of your orders. And I said, well, where am I going? He said, back to Vietnam.
I rolled in on the target. I had a three-ship aircraft, a three-ship formation. And I rolled in on the target. I had 650-pound bombs, and I pickled my bombs off and pulled off the target. And as soon as I pulled off the target, my right wing dipped, which made me know that my right rack didn't go off. So I put it in burner and did a big whiff-a-dill while my other two guys were on the target. And when I came back down, I released my three. But then I felt this bump, whoom. And I said, gee whiz, it must be some jet wash, okay? From the other two aircraft. So we go out to the tanker, and it was supposed to be a silent refueling. And the boom operator broke silence and said, F4 in its pre-contact position, you have right part of your right wing missing. And it was a hole in that dihedral about like so. And what had happened, an 85-millimeter round went right through that dihedral. It didn't explode. It was not fused correctly. And therefore, I wound up with a big hole rather than a destroyed aircraft.
My second tour of duty, I was in military intelligence, and I was a dual gunner for the commander of the aviation.
Being in combat is unusual. Most human beings never go through that. And I defy anybody to say they came back the same way they were.
I became a real leader over there. I became a real aviator over there, where my skills were put to the test on a daily basis.
you go to war at young age, you mature very quickly, and then you come back, you expect open arms. Oh, it was not true.
And when I came back, I wasn't spit on, but I was looked at in disdain.
That was the time when all the draft dodgers were against us for going to Vietnam. They treated us like animals. And we come into the airport, and they was up on a ramp, and they threw feces on us, they threw beer on us, they threw beer cans at us. You kill babies. I mean, they just gave us a they gave us a wreck over that you wouldn't. It was the worst homecoming that you can ever believe. And when a soldier tell you that, it is definitely true. And that was in April 1970.
A lot of guys that came home were told to take their uniforms off in civilian. I didn't have any civilian clothes, so I wore my uniform, and I was proud to wear my uniform. Damn right. Because my country sent me over there, and I did the best that I could do, you know. And I, to this day, I don't have any regrets about it.
War is a very unpopular thing to be in and start with. And then you have to let all of your personal feelings and attitudes go away, because you're a warrior. And that's your job on this earth, is to win for the United States of America.
Each pin on this map marks the location of an attack on Black Americans and their communities from the Civil War into the 1900s. It's no accident you're unlikely to find many of these in American history textbooks. There's been a concerted effort to whitewash and cover many of them up. But while some of the stories may have been scrubbed from the records and textbooks throughout history, survivors and their descendants are speaking out, shedding light on the violent events that took place in their communities and exposing the lingering social and economic damage caused by some of the worst racial violence in American history. After the American Civil War, the country entered a period known as Reconstruction, during which it set about reintegrating the Confederate States and nearly 4 million newly freed enslaved people. But African Americans were hardly given a foundation on which to build their new lives after the war. No reparations were paid to the formerly enslaved for what they and their families had endured for generations. Many had been told they'd be given a small plot of land to get started on. And while there were plans to allocate some land to the formerly enslaved after the war, such as Special Field Order No. 15, much of the land seized by Union forces or promised to African Americans was later given back to white Southern citizens, ex-slave owners, and to white Northern entrepreneurs. The following decade saw African Americans slowly gain more economic and political power. They bought land, started businesses, and built schools. But in many places where African Americans succeeded, white Americans set out to destroy that success.
The Civil War was a revolution. It destroyed the most powerful slave-owning class in the world. And now the question is, what's going to replace it? The freed people had a clear understanding of what their freedom meant. They wanted self-determination. They wanted to reconstitute their families. They wanted to live as far away from white people as they could. They basically wanted to be left alone, but they also wanted to be citizens, and they wanted to exercise the rights that other citizens did. And so on some level, Reconstruction was designed to answer this question about the meaning of freedom. And so African Americans became citizens. Slavery's abolished with the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, nationalizes citizenship, and creates due process. And so now Black people have equal protection before the law, and they can now run for office, hold office, and participate in society. It succeeded for a brief time that it existed. Black people were running for election, they were holding office, there were integrated schools. We were beginning to act and behave like a democracy. By 1877, as the North tires of Reconstruction, we see the withdrawal of troops, and on some level, really, the withdrawal of federal protection of Black people's rights. Just because the federal government said Reconstruction was over did mean that Black people stopped living their lives like free people. They continued to hold office. They continued to form these very important biracial political parties and movements. They joined interracial unions. They began to own businesses, in some cases owning land. Extraordinary success in the face of a lot of violence and not much federal protection. But what happens in the 1890s is that the Southern elite decides for themselves what the meaning of freedom is going to be. They're going to strip Black people of their citizenship. White supremacy is reconstituted in the 1890s. It can't look the same as it did in slavery. And so what you end up with is disfranchisement and segregation and sharecropping and convict labor and debt peonage. But underwriting that is extraordinary violence and terror.
I like this phrase that sociologists and historians often use to describe the country in terms of race relations. And that is that this was a period they described as the nadir of race relations in America, the low point of race relations in America. And they use that language because there was this proliferation of these events that were called race riots that were mainly assault on Black communities. It was in New York and Philadelphia, Baltimore and Memphis and Omaha and Chicago and D.C. Summer and fall of 1919 was dubbed by James Weldon Johnson, who was with the NAACP, as Red Summer. Red is a metaphorical reference to blood that flowed through the streets from all this violence post-World War I. The other thing that's happening during this period is lynching. Lynching is simply a form of domestic terrorism aimed more often than not at Black folks. The real aim is to strike fear in the hearts and minds of a group, Black folks in this case, to make sure that Black folks knew and stayed in their place. And so lynching was running rampant during this period.
The Elaine that we see today is very different from the Elaine at the time of the massacre. At the time of the massacre, it was one of the fastest growing cities and local economies in the state. The bulk of this new revenue that was coming in was from cotton sales. Cotton's at the heart of understanding what happened during the Elaine massacre. First of all, there are sharecroppers. The official name for it is debt peonage. On its surface, it seems very, very fair. Planters offer plots of their land to sharecroppers in exchange for their labor. The way the system is supposed to work is at the end of the growing season, the profits from the harvest are supposed to be split 50-50, half going to the planter, the other half going to the laborer. However, this isn't what normally happens. There's an inherent problem when you have a planter that has to go a whole growing season and he has no income. You have to ask yourself, how does he survive? And he survives by borrowing from the planter. And this is where the plantation store comes into play. Every plantation had a plantation store. Its sharecroppers could go to that store and get items on credit. What most people don't know is that the credit offered at this store was at astronomical rates. Even when the sharecropper received his half of the shares, quite often because of these doctored books and these inflated prices, he was never able to get out of debt. And therefore, he really could not leave because he owed money. What sharecropping or debt peonage did was enable planters to have a workforce that they virtually paid nothing for. The planters would sell the cotton and quite often come back and say, well, this is all I got for it, and pay the sharecropper only a fraction of the half that he was supposed to get. This kept them in perpetual debt, and with a judicial system that was not going to allow them to leave the debt hanging, the sharecroppers were in essence made slaves. African Americans had just gone off to war. So many African Americans who had participated in the war were given promises that if they went and fought this war, they return as full-fledged citizens. So when they return to these cotton fields and they find themselves being cheated just as they had before, they believe that they have recourse. And the recourse that they believe they have now is the courts. They band together, form a union, hire an attorney, and this will be their undoing once the planters find out. The last evening of September of 1919, there is a meeting called for the Progressive Farmers and Household Union. This was the union that the sharecroppers had formed to sue the plantation owners for their rights. Plantation owners got wind that these meetings were happening. They sent out bands of people who are also sheriffs and law enforcement, but also individuals who work on those plantations as sort of overseers. There's a shooting that occurs right outside of one of the meetings. Two of the individuals who have been sent there by the planters, two of them law enforcement agents, one is injured and one is killed. And when the report gets out of the shooting, those individuals that had gone there, the RAS, the meeting, will begin passing on messages that are totally unfounded at that point, that there was an insurrection going to take place and that this insurrection was intended to overthrow the county and displace white rule there. The response to that report will be that hundreds of individuals will pour in from neighboring counties. The white American Legion that had just been established months before would be deputized. These men are sent out to arrest the union members. And there's a shootout when they return and try to arrest them. From DC, orders will come to the governor and to military bases there that 500 troops would be mobilized and sent in by the federal government. Even though the sharecroppers are arrested, this isn't enough to stop the mobs that have already been called in. They begin shooting at any Black person that they saw. Many Blacks will begin hiding in the swamps or hiding in thickets. These men in small groups will begin hunting them out. They saw the military trains arrive, and when the troops came looking for Blacks, they assumed that they were there to help them. So Blacks began coming out of the woods and going toward the soldiers and were shot down, some of them by machine gunners. The governor himself raced over in a car to try to be there for the photo ops and to participate.
My grandfather said they were surrounding people and they was shooting first and asking questions later, even with women and children. They lost friends in the massacre because all of them stayed in the area. And when people came, they were just shooting everybody. They wasn't, you got seen, you got shot.
Everything was just shoot to kill, shoot to kill. And then I was told that when they had killed the Black, a ditch was dug and they all were thrown into that ditch as one big lump sum, not a grave, not a burial, but all were thrown in a ditch.
Their homes were formerly slave cabins that are on the property or shanties that had been largely established by the planters and weren't owned by them. What we see is looting of these cabins, the taking of the little livestock they have, and the taking of property that belonged to them. We do not know how many people were killed. There has never been a single grave that has been discovered or recovered. People had to make a conscious decision whether you stayed and you continued to work or whether you fled. And a great number of people fled after this event.
According to some descendants, as residents fled the town and surrounding Phillips County, they were forced to leave behind land they owned, which was then stolen by white residents, some of whom perpetrated the massacre. While evidence of Black land ownership in and around Elaine from the time period has been difficult to find, some Black descendants claim that's because a lot of the documents were likely destroyed. What is clear is that a consistent oral history of land theft has been passed down through generations of Black residents of Phillips County.
We ain't got no proof, but we do have the oral stories. And if you listen to the oral stories, all of them assisted. You know, people can't make this stuff up. You know, if you listen to these stories, you cannot make this up.
The families of plantation owners have made themselves considerably wealthy from the cotton boom that took place there and the generations that were able to either exploit slavery or exploit Black labor through debt peonage. But there was no profit and there was no gain for the individuals who actually were out there doing the work. And now, like the old hedge clippers, they've all been discarded, forgotten, left behind. And that's where Elaine is today. It has some of the highest poverty rates in the country, high unemployment rates. It's riddled with health issues. poor drinking water. There is no school in the town. They have to bus their children out.
It's a lot of money here, but there's no generation wealth for black people. When the killing was over, all the wealth for black people just went away.
Going to Elaine is like going to the end of the world. There's only one way in and one way out.
One of the ironies about Oklahoma is that it comes late into statehood, 1907, and it had been promoted even by black folks as kind of a promised land, a Beulah land, a land of opportunity, because it had not come into statehood and there were diverse folks here, including natives. There were calls for black folks to come to Oklahoma to get away from the Deep South and the rigid segregation that existed there. Tulsa really transitioned from sort of a dusty Western outpost to a much more a cosmopolitan city at the turn of the 20th century, primarily attributable to the discovery of oil. Tulsa was a segregated city, as were many cities during this period. The black community sat just north of the Frisco tracks. Black folks were segregated into this geographic area, but they actually leveraged segregation to create an economic enclave. It was very successful because folks were, based on the constraint of segregation, forced to trade with and do business with one another. It became an enclave of not just entrepreneurs and business folks, but a bunch of professionals, doctors, lawyers, dentists, accountants, etc. And there were economic successes throughout the country in these segregated black neighborhoods and some beyond the confines of segregation. Oklahoma, in the run-up to statehood, becomes really a bastion of the same kind of white supremacist notions that existed in the Deep South. The massacre was caused by a number of things. The Greenwood District, the black community in Tulsa, sat on land that was desired by industrialists, including railroad executives. We also have to think about white supremacy and the psychological dynamics that were operative, not just in Tulsa, but throughout the United States. In Tulsa, you have kind of an extreme example because you have black wealth in this segregated community that abuts downtown Tulsa, white Tulsa. If you're a white person, you could literally stand on the Frisco tracks and look over into North Tulsa and see black folks who were driving nice cars, owning their own homes, having their own businesses. And that was, in my estimation, the cause for cognitive dissonance. Black folks were faring much better economically in Tulsa than many white folks thought they should be. Another factor was the KKK. The Ku Klux Klan, an iconic domestic terrorist organization which had a foothold in Oklahoma throughout the 1920s. Tulsa was no exception. Add to that the media. One particular media outlet called the Tulsa Tribune, a daily afternoon newspaper, published a series of incendiary articles and editorials that really fomented hostility in the white community against the black community during the run-up to the massacre. And that's the context. Those are the atmospherics of Tulsa as we talk about May 31st and June 1st, the days of the massacre. The incident began with an elevator incident. There was a black boy whose name was Dick Rowland, 19 years old, who shined shoes for a living. He needed to use the restroom one morning. This is May 30th. Facilities available for his use were limited because of segregation. He knew that there was such a facility on the third floor of the downtown Drexel building. He has to take the elevator up to the third floor. Elevators back then are manually operated. A young white girl named Sarah Page is manually operating this elevator. Something happened on the elevator. We don't know exactly what it was. We'll never know, likely. But it likely was that he bumped into or brushed up against Sarah Page. Some say he stepped on her foot. In any event, she overreacted. She began screaming. The elevator landed back in the lobby. Dick Rowland, frightened, as well he probably should be given the circumstances, frightened, ran from the elevator. Sarah Page is distraught. She exits the elevator. She's comforted by a clerk from Renberg's, which is a locally owned store. He's concerned about her. She talks about being assaulted on the elevator. He calls the police. She ultimately recants the original story, refuses to cooperate with prosecutors after Dick Rowland has been arrested. Unfortunately, by the time the recantation occurs, it's too late. And it's too late in part because the Tulsa Tribune published an article the next day. It's entitled, "Nab Negro for Attacking Girl in an Elevator," painting it as an attempted rape in broad daylight. There's language in that article that clearly is intended to make Sarah Page look more virtuous, the corollary effect of which is to make Dick Rowland look more villainous. And it has its desired effect. A large mob of white men began to gather. Dick Rowland had been arrested by this time by the sheriff, put in jail, put set atop the courthouse. White men gathered on the lawn of the courthouse. Ultimately, the white mob numbered in the thousands. The sheriff was so concerned that he actually called down to the offices of the Tulsa Star, the black newspaper. He knew that there would be black men gathered there, and told him what had transpired, that Dick Rowland was arrested, that he was being held in jail, that he was safe, he's being protected. But he was concerned because he was hearing this lynch talk among this large and growing white mob. A number of black men, several dozen in number, some of them World War I veterans with weapons who knew how to use them, marched down to the courthouse intent on protecting Dick Rowland from what they thought would be a certain lynching. They were confronted by the larger white mob. As you might imagine, words were exchanged. A white man tried to take a black man's gun, the gun discharged. And in the words of some of the massacre survivors, all hell broke loose after that. The so-called riot was on, and it resulted in the devastation of the Greenwood community. Many people in the white mob, many of these men, were actually deputized by local law enforcement. They affirmatively prevented the fire department from putting out the fires that raged. Planes flew over the Greenwood community, privately owned planes. And according to eyewitness, dropped incendiary devices, bombs on the community that caused the flames to burn more brilliantly and spread more rapidly. The National Guard was ultimately called in to quell the violence, which they did on the afternoon of June 1st, 1921, the next day. The official death toll is 37. Nobody who's studied these events believes that to be true. It's more likely within a range of 100 to 300. At least 1,250 homes in the black community were destroyed as well, as were a number of churches, schools, business places, and other commercial establishments. The Red Cross provided relief immediately post-massacre, food, shelter, clothing. By all accounts, did a wonderful job. Black folks, particularly black men, were rounded up and taken to internment centers throughout the city for a temporary period. It was ostensibly for their own protection, but according to survivors, it left the community essentially defenseless and unprotected. So looters came in and pillaged homes of finery like jewelry and expensive items that some of the more wealthy residents of the community had owned.
The Tulsa and Elaine massacres were not isolated incidents. They were just two of many, and they were representative of a broad backlash to the social status of black people in the United States. The goal of attacks like these, historians say, was to maintain white supremacy by any means necessary. And the effects of these attacks on black communities can still be seen and felt today.
You know, some people will say, well, slavery ended years ago, or even, you know, segregation ended years ago. You know, that's in the past. Why are you dredging up the past? Well, the past isn't the past. And I think my whole body of research that I've done, looking at different events all across the world, you find this over and over and over, that the effects of the past linger and they have consequences. And in general, if these events are historically important enough, they shape the way the world is today. After learning about the Tulsa massacre and reading a bit about it and realizing we don't have a lot of hard statistical evidence about what the consequences were, that's basically where I came in, is just wanting to know what were the consequences of the Tulsa massacre. So immediately after the massacre, we find that black household heads who owned homes fell by 4.5 percentage points. And then if you think of another measure of that is, are you an individual that's living in a home that's owned by someone in your family? That measure of homeownership fell by 6.3 percentage points. And the other thing that we find is decline in occupational status. And one measure of occupational status is to look at, is an individual working in a white collar occupation? There's a 3.1% chance that you're in a white collar occupation. Then after the massacre, that figure falls by 2.3 percentage points. So that's a huge, huge effect. It's 66% decline in white collar occupations. That result is controlling for, taking into account everything else that's going on in the economy and also between different racial groups. But it's not just in Tulsa, but we see these effects in other parts of the country as well. So we look at newspapers all across the US and basically look and see, are they covering the massacre in the days right after? And what we find is where there is more intensity of coverage about the massacre, the effects that we find in Tulsa, we also find in those communities as well.
Just like we know that there's a thing such as generational wealth, there's also generational poverty. What we found in working through the Justice for Greenwood Foundation and our work with our survivors and descendants is that this generational poverty or generational lack of opportunity started with the massacre. And let's talk about Viola Fletcher. After the massacre, and Mother Fletcher had to flee for her life with her family to Claremore to live in an impoverished state, she was not able to go back and finish school. And it caused her lots of problems in life. Well, most of her life, she was a domestic worker, working for pennies, working for white families that treated her less than they treated their dogs. You know, Lessie Benefield Randall, also a little girl at the time, only 6 years old. But she was in town with her grandmother, Molly Benefield. And obviously during the massacre, she's a young lady. She says she can't remember a lot, but she does remember running. She does remember them coming to the door saying, the blacks need to get out. The white people are killing all the blacks, particularly the black men. She remembers being taken to the fairgrounds, which was one of the places they put our people in those, what they called at the time, concentration camps. Hughes Van Ellis, we call him Uncle Red. And obviously he was a baby. He was an infant. At the time of the massacre, I think he was 6 months old. Hughes Van Ellis and Viola Fletcher are brother and sister. They live a lot of his childhood outside. I mean, they basically lived in like a tent. They basically had to survive off the land, and it was very traumatizing for him and something that shaped his life.
A 2018 study from the American Journal of Economics and Sociology estimated that if 1,200 median-priced houses in Tulsa were destroyed today, the loss would be around $150 million. The additional loss of other assets, including cash, personal belongings, and commercial property, might bring the total to over $200 million.
So the Greenwood community, as a business community, was destroyed. As a testament to the resilience and the indomitable human spirit that was endemic in the community was fully rebuilt, began to really boom, peaking in the early to mid-1940s. That continued throughout the 50s, began to decline in the 60s and 70s for a couple of reasons that are really important to the story, if you want to connect 1921 to the present. At the macro level, one of the major things that happened was integration found its way to Tulsa. The Greenwood community as a business community was successful largely because it was a closed market, which was attributed to the Jim Crow laws that existed. So because of segregation, there was a need for a Greenwood community. Black folks couldn't get what they needed or couldn't ply their trades in the larger dominant white community, so they created their own economic space. Even the black folks that work outside the community bring their dollars ultimately back in the community. That begins to change when the world begins to change because of integration. So black dollars then have another outlet. It's hard for a sole proprietor, a mom and pop type small business in the Greenwood community to compete with Walmart. That opening up, ironically, has the economic effect of undermining the success of the black community. When the black community begins to decline because of integration and other systemic factors, there's a movement in the 60s and 70s designed ostensibly to address blighted communities called urban renewal. So you see a blighted community, you come in with urban renewal, and you buy up the land and you take away the properties. So what then you get is black folks losing their businesses, losing the land, and really struggling. So today what we have in the Greenwood community is a community that is actually bustling, but it's not a community in which black folks own most of the land.
The pins on this map mark just some of the more well-documented attacks on black communities from the Civil War into the 1900s. But it doesn't include the countless other assaults on black communities during this time period, from countless lynchings to entire black communities being expelled from their towns by white mobs. The scale of damage here is, in many ways, incalculable. Families torn apart, communities destroyed, and generational wealth erased. Like many other communities impacted by these type of racist attacks throughout history, black residents of Tulsa and Elaine are still looking for justice and some semblance of closure.
I would love to know what happened to my people or my family, and if I can figure out what happened to them, if I could get information, that would be great. But I know that they're not going to give it to us.
Who owes the people? That argument could be had on a lot of different levels. You know, the governor himself participated in the massacre. So is the state responsible? The governor asked for federal troops to be sent in. Is the federal government responsible? Is the local government responsible? Are individuals responsible? So there's a lot of blame to throw around in this one. One of the things that makes this difficult is this lack of bodies. But if we're able to find mass graves and then connect those bodies to living individuals, we have people who have been harmed and people that you can pay reparations to.
When I think about reparations, I think of the denotation of the term. What does the term actually mean? It means to make amends or to repair damage. The fundamental question is there damage in this community that is in need of repair that we can trace back to 1921? I don't know anybody who can answer no to that question. The hard part is really talking through the nature of the damage and in terms of remediation, what things work best.
That's the only way we can get back to where we were. If we get that reparations, restitution, remedy, whatever word you wanted to use, a comprehensive plan that provides a remedy and benefit to those who suffered the harm.
There could be targeted economic investments in the black community, the community most harmed by the massacre. Curriculum reform. The whole point of curriculum reform is to include this history as an integral part of the curriculum, such that the errors of the past are not made again, and such that people, specifically black people, see themselves reflected in ways that embolden them and give them the psychological power to be creators and entrepreneurs in the present.
Without history, we don't have a true understanding of our nation, particularly our nation's most marginalized communities.
Somehow we need to be able to present this history as our history. And to help people understand that you're not responsible for the past. I'm not responsible for what my ancestors did, but I'm obligated to the present to do what I can to make things better.
Email from school about the incident today.
Scary.
You know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
Yeah, but if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, anything, you need to tell an adult, someone you know and trust. That can be hard, but speaking up about a problem is what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 on your radio or WRCT.org on your web browser or, you know, Waze. It is 7 o'clock. That means it is time for the WRCT radio calendar. Here are some things going on in our fair city. The 820 Liberty Gallery is showing Traveling Show, an exhibition by Renee Pachocki, featuring four distinct presentations, including photography, video, and books created on travel journeys through the Pacific Northwest, Montreal, and while living abroad in Japan, New Zealand, Chile, and Ecuador. The show is on display now through September 12th at 820 Liberty Avenue, downtown Pittsburgh. While you're downtown, swing by the Wood Street Galleries to check out Supply and Demand, a show by Ian Brill. It's a collection of performative light and sound installations exploring the balance between a consistent set of rules and evolving symbolic language and pre-existing constraints. Show is on display now through November 20th at 601 Wood Street, again in downtown Pittsburgh. For more information about either of those shows, visit trustarts.org. Pittsburgh City Parks continues the annual Movies in the Park series, showing various movies in various parks all around the city. Tonight, you can go to Schenley Park in Flagstaff Hill in Schenley Park to watch No Time to Die. Friday night, American Underdog is playing at Arsenal Park. Sunday, Finding Nemo is at the Schenley Plaza. For a list of locations and movies, you can go to the website pittsburghpa.gov/events/cinema. Liberty Magic presents The Expert at the Card Table by Guy Hollingsworth, one of London's most skilled magicians specializing in a unique and original style of card conjuring. The Expert at the Card Table tells the riveting story of Milton Franklin Andrews, a con man who was the finest card mechanic of his day. Guy Hollingsworth will be performing August 10th through October 2nd at 811 Liberty Avenue in downtown Pittsburgh. For more information, again, trustarts.org. And finally, you can stop by the Pittsburgh Banjo Club's regular rehearsal every Wednesday at 8 p.m. to enjoy their wonderful music and get a bite to eat, perhaps, and maybe a drink. Founded in 1988, the Pittsburgh Banjo Club is an all-volunteer band and organization that uses banjos, trumpets, tubas, bass, voice, all sorts of things to perform popular music from the 1920s and the 1930s. the Banjo Club rehearsals at the Allegheny Elks Lodge.